We will also discuss how trauma can be prevented and treated, particularly considering the daily trauma experienced by the oppressed children of Gaza.
As medical professionals dedicated to saving lives, we find it inconceivable. Explosives were discovered in tools and equipment. Pagers designed by the Israeli regime blinded hundreds of Lebanese.
Iranian hospitals have always been ready to help, and the healthcare assistance they offer this time is no different.
The injured brought to Iran after the pager blast received full coverage by the Iranian healthcare system. Appropriate actions were taken for them. Iranian hospitals treated over 500 injured Lebanese people.
In its genocidal war on Gaza and Lebanon, Israel has not spared even hospitals, leading to a tsunami of trauma among the people, medical professionals, paramedics, and most importantly, children. The Trauma Congress is an opportunity to discuss exactly that.
The ongoing conflict in Gaza has resulted in significant devastation to the healthcare infrastructure. Conferences like this, centered on Gaza's health conditions, can raise global awareness of the dire humanitarian crisis in the blockaded territory. Mehdi Nourouzi, Tehran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, man's God-seeking nature. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, this is Zainab with you on A to Z for IRIB English Radio, and I'm speaking about man's God-seeking nature. So these are some of the, in a sense, inner traits of man I'm talking about. Narrate something Imam Sada was asked about a particular surah, a particular verse in a surah in the Quran. So this is Surah 30, verse 30, which is that God's creation upon which he originated mankind. And so the Imam actually explained this and said that Allah originated mankind about Tawheed. So obviously we know that Tawheed is monotheistic faith, and the unity of Allah, which we all subscribe to. So this is very important. So this is obviously something that is hugely important for how we live. And maybe people aren't so aware of this the whole time. So there's something very beautiful inside all of us. And every single human being has this. We're given this, whether we are Muslims or whether the family, the parents sort of take the baby, the child out of Islam and make them have another faith. But upon birth, this is what we all have. So we have this tendency to perfection. We have this tendency towards beauty. We have a tendency towards worshipping, towards this Tawheed, towards worshipping this unified, omnipotent, perfect God. And so, and obviously, it actually says this, every child is born on the fitrah. So, and this is the same. So even if we're ignorant of it, we have this. And some people even go and explain even more about it, so in quite a lot of detail. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio with Sister Zainab, and I'm speaking to you a little bit about man's God-seeking nature, which is basically the fitrah that every human being is born on. And so it's been explained in detail. So some scholars will even say that belief in one God, belief in unity, belief in perfection, belief in the day of resurrection, belief in prophethood, belief in the existence of angels, belief in revelation, all these things are sort of packed in there when we come to this idea that we have an innateness of Tawheed. And you can imagine, so many children, you might observe this in young young kids, even if they're not really exposed to religion or a sort of religious environment, they will have an idea that there is birth, there is death. They will look at the world around them and sort of be in wonder and amazement over this huge, beautiful world with all its miracles and so. And, you know, this is something that all human beings have. Obviously, some people, non-Muslims and even Muslims, might then pile on, you know, the sins and the bad things, bad deeds, bad words, and somehow the fitra, in a sense, can get buried. But, you know, the... But it can always be retrieved. It depends how much effort we put in to try and get rid of all that, the junk, basically, we put on top of our fitra. So obviously, that's one thing. And you can admit, and you know, obviously we all like to be called good things. So if someone says, oh, that's a hardworking person, then we immediately think, oh, that's nice. I want to be called hardworking. I don't want to be called lazy. Because we have this in us. We know we have this drive towards wanting to be good. And we like that. We like if people think of us as good generally. So that's just a few insights for today. And I look forward to speaking to you again on A to Z. And this is Sister Zainab and Fiaman Allah and farewell. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
The war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu, who barely escaped death by drone some weeks ago, is now trying to avoid defeat on the battlefronts by plotting with the US to impose an unequal truce to the detriment of Lebanon. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote, "Remember the famous saying of the father of the Islamic Revolution? In the midst of the eight-year war, the U.S. had imposed on Iran, through its stooge Saddam, of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad, whose forces had occupied several thousand square kilometers of border areas, were attacking merchant ships in the Persian Gulf and bombing cities. In such a situation, the UN and the big powers, unfortunately some Muslim countries also, were pressuring the Islamic Republic to accept ceasefire with the aggressor and occupier of Iranian territories in order to numb the spirit of resistance of the defenders, thereby depriving them of their resolve to liberate the occupied parts of the homeland. Imposed peace is worse than imposed war," had said Imam Khomeini, calling on officials and the people to carry on the struggle until enemy forces retreat from Iranian territory. We are indeed indebted to the astute leadership of that sage of the age for our heroic emergence from the U.S. imposed war as a progressive, powerful, and prudent nation, which has defeated every intricate U.S. plot and, in the process, inspired iron resolve liberation movements in the region, such as Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist organization, the Hezbollah. In view of the Islamic Republic of Iran's ironclad support for the oppressed people struggling against aggressors, occupiers, usurpers, warmongers and terrorists of all hue and color, thanks to Imam Khomeini's worthy successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the axis of resistance is now bravely battling the illegal Zionist entity and its criminal godfather, the U.S. The genocide in Gaza, now in its 14th month, and the brutal bombing of the civilians of Lebanon for almost the past 2 months by the devilish U.S.-Israeli duo, has failed to break the spirit of resistance of the defenders, with not even the faintest signs of victory for history's most brutal mass murderers. If Hamas and Islamic Jihad are far from decimated, despite the slaughter of 44,000 people and reduction of towns to rubble, Hezbollah, after having offered as martyrs to the cause of truth and justice some of its senior leaders, including Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah, has lost none of its indomitable fighting prowess. It is worth recalling how we drove the Israelis from Lebanon in 2000 and blunted the Zionist war machine during the 33-day war of 2006 to earn laurels as the only Arab fighting force, and that too non-state, to shatter the myth of the Zionist entity's military invincibility. Now, while its drones and missiles are accurately targeting the enemy's military and industrial centers, of course, sparing civilians, its combatants are holding at bay the 50,000 Israeli troops massed on the border by inflicting mounting casualties upon them and thwarting all attempts to occupy even a single village. The war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu, who barely escaped death by drone some weeks ago, is now trying to avoid defeat on the battlefronts by plotting with the U.S. to impose an unequal truce to the detriment of Lebanon. The Hezbollah is too sagacious to be deceived by such sinister plots, though it has rightly said it is willing for the end of hostilities, provided its terms and conditions are met. And this includes not just end to the bombing of Lebanon, but a stopping the bloodbath in Gaza as well. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, well aware of regional and global developments, has sent a special emissary to the Hezbollah and the people of Lebanon, reaffirming Iran's staunch support for the axis of resistance and whatever the forces at the front defending their faith, country, and honor deem prudent. Dr. Ali Larijani, the former Iranian parliamentary speaker, delivered the fatherly message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to Hezbollah officials, to Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri, and to Prime Minister Najib Mikati. The Islamic Republic of Iran is confident of the disgraceful defeat once again of the Zionist entity and its terrorist backers at the hands of the Axis of Resistance.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we will be speaking to an acclaimed academic and author who has been at the forefront of numerous high-profile human rights fights for justice. Now an adopted son of Belfast, he's never found wanting when his wisdom or expertise is called for local or grassroots communities. But before we do, let's get a quick overview on this week's topic.
On the 15th of April 1989, a severe crush in two central pens at Hillsborough Stadium, Sheffield, led to the deaths of 97 Liverpool fans. It occurred as the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest kicked off. Shortly before kick-off, the inexperienced match commander, Chief Superintendent David Duckinfield, with a clear view above the terrace from the police control box, ordered exit gate C to be opened to ease crowding at malfunctioning turnstiles. Fans, unstewarded, entered through gate C and down an unlawful 1-in-6 gradient tunnel headed standing. Yet the pens were already severely overcrowded. Fans were trapped by high fences to the sides and to the front. So severe was the crush, a barrier collapsed and bodies piled up. In addition to the eventual 97 deaths, 766 fans were injured and thousands traumatised. The deadliest tragedy in British sporting history. In the immediate aftermath, South Yorkshire senior police officers and the Police Federation fed false stories to the media, claiming violent Liverpool fans, many without tickets and drunk, had caused the disaster. These allegations persisted throughout a hostile media despite Lord Justice Taylor's 1990 interim report finding the main cause was the police failure to control the crowd. Yet, there were no prosecutions of police officers or public bodies, and initial inquests returned an accidental death verdict. This led to a 3-decades-long campaign by bereaved families and survivors. Addressing the 20th anniversary memorial at Anfield in front of a crowd of 30,000, the Culture Secretary, Andy Burnham, committed the Labour government to full documentary disclosure by all organisations involved. In 2010, the Hillsborough Independent Panel was appointed by the UK government to oversee and analyse the disclosed documents and publish a detailed report. On the 12th of September 2012, it published its report. It launched a website containing extensive material collated from 85 organisations and individuals over 2 years. The panel concluded that the behaviour of fans in no way contributed to the disaster. The main cause was lack of police control. Crowd safety had been compromised at every level, despite previous near-death incidents on the terrace. The panel concluded that up to 41 of those who died might have survived had the response of the police and emergency services been appropriate. Before a packed House of Commons, Prime Minister David Cameron apologised on behalf of the government, Ed Miliband on behalf of the opposition. Other authorities, including the South Yorkshire Police, followed suit. Former editor of The Sun, Kelvin McKenzie, initially apologised for making false accusations under the headline The Truth. Subsequently, this was moderated. New inquests were initiated lasting 2 years. The jury concluded all who died had been unlawfully killed, and the fans were exonerated of any blame.
And with that, I would like to introduce my guest. Professor Phil Scraton has been a leading light for those challenging corrupt institutional power structures. Widely known for his work on the Hillsborough Independent Panel, a team that was instituted to oversee the disclosure of documents about the disaster that led to the deaths of 97 Liverpool fans in 1989, he has been at the centre of many other successful institutional findings since. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean.
So, Phil, tell me first of all a bit about yourself growing up.
Well, I was born on the other side of the river from Liverpool in Wallasey. My mother was from Birkenhead, a Birkenhead Catholic, an Irish background. My father was a Liverpool-born Protestant. And so I was the product of a mixed marriage, and so understood right from the outset the issues that the tensions that exist around religion, particularly the tensions between Irish Catholicism and English Protestantism. And my father converted, actually, but never went to church. And I grew up in not a very wealthy family, but somehow one of the only handful of people from my school. I got the 11 plus, went to a grammar school, which I hated from the moment I walked in. It was a former public school, and it had all those traditions. And the young ones got beaten by the old ones and all of that. It was a dreadful introduction to the world of immediate power relations on that level. And it worked at two levels. One, I felt that subjugation because I was a Catholic in a Protestant grammar school. But I also felt the subjugation of poverty. I came from a home where my mother and father had to scrimp just to get me to the school, to buy the uniform, for example, and all the gear that goes with that. So I felt lost. And within 2 years, I'd left. And believe it or believe it not, these days, I went into a seminary. I'd been an altar boy since I'd been very young in the local Catholic church. And, yeah, the priest would come round every Friday night and they'd talk and chat. And they got me to play for the local church team and all of that. So my first love was football and Liverpool FC, which I know won't go down that well with you, Sean. But that was my first love. And second was, I suppose, I was devoted to the church. I mean, I was, 8, 9, 10, 11 when I was on the altar. So it seemed obvious to me that maybe going off and trying to emulate the priests that I had so admired at that time, that was why I went into the seminary. There was also, at that time, another formative moment which never left me and which I should have realised even at that age was the real contradiction. There was a wee fella in my church, in my school, who was really poor. We weren't well off, but he was really poor. And he used to steal from the local shop, but he didn't steal sweets. And he didn't steal lemonade, he stole food. And that food he would steal to take to his family. And this was the first time I ever experienced anything like this. Later in life, I went through this again. And he got caught. And I'll never forget the day all the girls were taken out of assembly and all the women teachers left the assembly. And we sat cross-legged on the floor. And we didn't know what was happening. So there was a bang at the back of the hall, and we were sat there rigid, and these two teachers walked up. They looked massive from where we were, and Wee Frank was walking between them, And they got him up to the stage, and the head teacher was on the stage, the deputy head, and the local parish priest. And the head teacher looked at all of us and said, "This week, Frank Ruddy was found stealing, and he is on the stage because of that. He let himself down, he let the school down, he let his family down, but most of all, he let God down." And they took him, they bent him over a desk, and they caned him 6 times across his backside, and they marched him down from the stage, and as he walked past, the tears were streaming down his face. Otherwise, he was emotionless. I sat there terrified. In fact, I was holding on to myself. I thought I was going to wet myself. And I learned a lesson that day, that moment, which didn't really click for a while afterwards. It was about the use and abuse of power, physical abuse of power. And that stayed with me. Even after that, when I went to the seminary, that stayed with me. And I saw that sort of behavior again in the seminary. And I lived for 4 years in under that fear, in that kind of situation. And also in the seminary, I was very well aware that some of my friends were being abused. And I left the seminary in 1966. In fact, I will never forget the moment I left the seminary. It was like a massive pressure lifted from me. It also coincided with the World Cup, and I went to Goodison Park three times to see the Brazil match, the Portugal match, and the North Korea match. And that was my first and last experience of Everton's football ground. Of course, I was never missed across the park at Anfield.
Well, we both have many discussions on the rivalry between Everton and Liverpool, but we'll save that for another day.
Yeah.
So tell me, Phil, how did you come to work and live in Belfast? Because you're now an adopted son.
After I got into academic work, and that was a strange experience in itself, because when I was finishing university, my first degree, which was sociology at Liverpool University, the thing that was said to me straight away was, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Oh, I'd like to be a researcher." And basically, the career guidance guy who was in the School of Sociology smiled and laughed and said, "No, I don't think you'd be cut out for research. I think you should go and be a social worker or a teacher or whatever." And nothing against social work or teaching, but I really wanted to do research. And so I enrolled for a master's by research, and I did it on the Irish-born Liverpool travelling community. And I witnessed there some of the worst racism I have ever seen. I come from a city where racism, particularly institutionalised by the police, on the Liverpool-born black community is really serious. But this was of a different order, seeing people dragged from their trailers in the middle of the night, their families. And I suddenly thought, am I a researcher or am I a witness to what is state abuse? So I wrote all that up, and that kind of steered me then into work in academic life, where the research was always going to be geared to abuse of power. And that work went on all the way through from that period, all the way through my work on institutionalized racism on Merseyside, my work on deaths in custody, my work on a whole range of controversial topics, which included eventually disasters and tragedies. And it was against that background that my, for want of a better word, career developed. I worked at the Open University full time, then I worked at Edge Hill University, Liverpool University, and then I came to Belfast. I remember after the interview, I was travelling back to Aldergrove, and I was in the taxi, and the guy said, "What have you been here for?" And I said, "I've been over for an interview." And he said, "What on earth do you want to come to this place for?" That was his response to, "You live in Liverpool, why do you want to come here?" And I thought to myself, this is a crazy question, because in my head, and I'd been coming here, I'd been a failure a lot, I'd done a lot of different things here, different talks, and I knew quite a few people in Belfast. And to me, I saw it as a privilege that I'd been offered a job in Belfast. Because when else in your life would you have the opportunity to live and work in a place that is going through transition from conflict? This is on my doorstep. People in England had not even the slightest notion of what was really happening in the north. And from my point of view, to come here and to work in this environment during a period of transition, and this was a period when, as you will remember only too well, 20 years ago, when there was a lot of tension, particularly in the paramilitaries, amongst the loyalist paramilitaries, there was a lot of tension. And it was getting a lot of headlines in England. But to me, it wasn't about that. To me, it was about being part of the society which was really going to face major transitions. Because I think when people talk about the transition from war to peace, what they failed to think about is, at a distance, it looks like the war is over, peace prevails, everything changes. Well, it doesn't. We all know that is a complete myth. Anybody who's lived here knows that that is a complete myth. Because in that situation, intergenerational trauma becomes such a powerful force. People who've been in prison for long periods of time, people, hardly a family that hasn't, in working class communities, hardly a family that hasn't lost somebody or hasn't witnessed some of the worst examples of power being directed against them individually, whether by paramilitaries on the one hand, but most significantly by the state, the armed forces. I never forgot the moment when somebody said to me, one of the very first times I came here, when I went to school, she said, every day I came out of my house, I had to step over a rifle because we lived in a corner house. And the squaddie would be down with his rifle across the front of the step. And I had to step over that. That image stayed in my mind of a child. You know, I mean, yes, we all know the major atrocities. We all know the major conflict. We all know the situation of shootings, of bombings, and all the rest of it. We know that. But that one image of a young child stepping over that barrel every day and it being normalized as part of her life really stayed with me. So arriving in Belfast and witnessing and listening to people's stories, there was some of that was part of my own history, but not to the depth, not to the real pain of everyday life that had become normalized. And that to me was so significant. And the realization, working as I did with families, by that time families of the bereaved, families of prisoners, in a broader sense, that to me really had an impact, because what it was saying to me was, you know, this is an issue that's not going to go away in the medium period. So when people talk about transition from conflict, they have to understand that transition takes 3 generations minimum. I see that with my daughter-in-law, who was born in the former East, in Berlin. I see it from her family's experiences, that you don't unlive the lived lives of your grandparents, of your parents, simply because you're born at a moment of peace. And you inherit that background, you inherit that suffering. The things that are said and left unsaid in families are all part of that history. So for me, it's I work around the issue of about 3 generations when we can start to put real meaningfulness on, yes, the society has transitioned. And it's not just about who's in power and what their histories are. That's part of it. But it's actually about personal experience.
I completely agree, Phil. And there's something that struck me. Me and you had a conversation one time about Manson. I know we have all these cliches and all these buzzwords around the peace process, etc. But I'd said to you, we've been talking about something that Manson, you know, a post-conflict society. And you stopped me and you says, we're not in a post-conflict society, we're still in conflict. Yeah. And like it made me think, and you're absolutely right. to think that we're able to talk about a post-conflict society when there's so much trauma in our society still, when the injustices are still there, when the state is redacting documents, when they're burying the truth, when they're changing laws so families can't get to the truth, killing civil cases, inquests. We're not even in the end of the period where there is a post-conflict society. I think the British government is fighting a war on a new front against victims and survivors. So it did strike me when you said that, you know.
The inequality of arms that exists during a period of conflict, let's be clear about this. The inequality of arms is about a state intervening in a conflicted society. The state is not neutral. The state is never neutral. The state always supports a status quo which it considers is in its own best interests. And I'm talking here about not just about individual politicians, because there have been some good individual politicians, but I'm talking about the British state as an entity. And it has to protect its history. It has to protect its own direct involvement, not only in the deployment of the military in the north, but also it has to protect its reputation in terms of being seen to be value neutral, which it never was. It's not only in the north, which is the north of Ireland, which is in itself a major, major issue in terms of state involvement. But you see it at every level in the work I do, where the state interests, whether they're the police, the prisons, whatever, the state interests are always protected. So getting to the truth in the north is something that is not in the state's interest. To have the whole truth and nothing but the truth will never happen. I'm convinced it will never happen. In the work I do, not just on the north, but in the work I do, I see redacted documents. I see what it means for those in authority to go through documents and strike out passages. I've seen what it's like. I'm talking here, for example, around Hillsborough. I mean, these are 97 people who die at a football match, right? This is not about a civil war. This is about people dying at a football match. And I've seen how a panel of carefully selected police officers, under the direction of the chief constable, go through the statements of all of their police officers and review them and alter them. Now, review and alteration are not my words, they're their words. That's what they set up. So if you project that from 97 people dying at a football match into a situation where you have a war, where you have a relationship between the military and the police, why would we be surprised to discover that documents go missing, documents don't exist that should have existed, that when those documents are found, that they are redacted, that they are changed? Why would we be surprised if it can happen in the event of protecting reputations around policing football in a peaceful society, a harmonious society? Why would we be surprised that during a time when the state itself is conducting a war, when there is military on the streets, when the helicopters are flying in hour after hour, why would we be surprised to find that the truth is redacted in statements, or it's never written, or it's hidden? Doesn't surprise me in the slightest.
Phil, I want to thank you again for coming over to this side of the city to see me. You're always welcome, and it's always great to have you here in the West. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd once again like to thank our special guest, Phil Scraton. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Let's recite the Quran.
وَإِذَا قَرَأْتَ الْقُرْآنَ جَعَلْنَا بَيْنَكَ وَبَيْنَ الَّذِينَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْآخِرَةِ حِجَابًا مَسْتُورًا
الْقُرْآنُ نُورٌ وَبَيَانٌ الْقُرْآنُ هَدْيُ الْإِيمَانِ الْقُرْآنُ مِسْكُ الْخِتَامِ يَا قُرْآنُ عَلَيْكَ سَلَامٌ
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله respected brothers and sisters dear listeners listening to IRB English Radio all over the world welcome to let's recite the Quran Kareem inshallah today we will be practicing ayah 23 of surah
Yunus
on page 211. So brothers and sisters, dear listeners, as you're listening to us right now, turn to page 211 of the Quran Kareem, Surah Yunus, Ayah 23. Let's listen to the recitation of this ayah, then inshallah we'll come and practice it.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. يبغون في الأرض بغير الحق يا أيها الناس إنما بغيكم على أنفسكم متاع الحياة الدنيا ثم إلينا مرجعكم فننبئكم بما كنتم تعملون
Nice recitation, mashallah. Allah Almighty says in Ayah 23 of Surah Yunus, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم فلما أنجاهم إذا هم يبغون في الأرض بغير الحق But when he delivers them, when Allah Almighty... In the previous ayah, we were talking about people who were hit by a storm, first of all, by a favorable wind, and they were enjoying, not remembering Allah Almighty, just busy with their own business. And as soon as a storm hit them, there will be...
Remembering
God. They will be asking Allah, Oh Allah, save us, please. If you save us, if you deliver us from this storm, لَإِنْ أَنْجَيْتَنَا مِنْ هَذِهِ لَنَكُنَنَّ مِنَ الشَّاكِرِينَ Right?
Yes.
So, okay. Allah Almighty saves them, delivers them. Let's see, will they keep their words or no? فَلَمَّا أَنْجَاهُمْ But when he delivers, when Allah Almighty delivers them and saves them, إِذَا هُمْ يَبْغُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ بِغَيْرِ الْحَقِّ Behold, remember, they commit violations on the earth unjustly. Okay? بِغَيْرِ الْحَقِّ They will be corrupting the world. They will be causing a lot of corruptions on the earth. Ya ayyuhannas, Allah Almighty talks to us. Allah Almighty does not say, Ya, O Muslims. Ya ayyuhannas, to all of us, because He's the Lord of all of us, mankind. Yes or no?
Yeah.
Yes.
Our God, Allah, is not only the God of Muslims. Alright? It's the God of everyone. Everyone. All mankind. Innama baghyukum ala anfusikum. Your violations are only to your own self. It means if you are causing any corruption, don't think like your corruption hits me. Your corruption hits yourself. All right?
Yes.
Yeah. If you commit sins, you think by committing sins, you harm me, God. Don't think that way. It's not that way. It just harms yourself. Our sins do not hit Allah Almighty. The same as our prayers do not benefit Allah Almighty. Okay? يا أيها الناس وإنما بغيكم على أنفسكم متاع الحياة الدنيا. These are the wares of the life of this world. متاع الحياة الدنيا. ثم إلينا مرجعكم. You have like 60 years, 70 years living in this world. Don't forget your future, your eternal life. Your marji', the place that you will return, is with us. You will return to us. ثم إلينا, towards us, is your return. إلينا مرجعكم. Then to us will be your return. فننبئكم, whereat we will inform you بما كنتم تعملون, concerning what you used to do. So, refer to the Tafasir books, inshallah, and learn more. Ali Nasir, would you please recite ayah 23rd of Surah Yunus?
Yes.
Inshallah, we'll be practicing the tajweed points. Everyone, let's listen to Ali Nasir once.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
Listen to him.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
ما شاء الله.
فلما أنجاهم إذا هم يبغون في الأرض بغير الحق.
أحسنتم.
يا أيها الناس إنما بغيكم على أنفسكم.
الله الله ما شاء الله.
متاع الحياة الدنيا.
أحسنتم.
ثم إلينا مرجعكم فننبئكم بما كنتم تعملون.
أحسنتم. All the tajweed points were applied. ما شاء الله. Let's recite a salawat for him.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Allah bless you, Ali Nasir. That was very good. That was very good, mashallah.
هذا القرآن يوحدنا لطريق الخير يوجهنا الله تعالى أنزله ورسول الله معلمنا ورسول الله معلمنا.
Want to learn Quran at home? Join us in our Quranic class. Let's recite the Quran.
Let's pinpoint some points here. Some tajweed points. Falamma. Make sure whenever the letter mim has a
shadda.
And also the letter noon, which has a shadda sign.
Yeah.
Two things you should remember. Number one?
Nasal sound.
Nasal sound. Nasal sound. Second thing?
Extended for two counts.
Extension for two beats. Thumma inna. Okay, remember this. Next point here. Anjahum. How do you read it, Masum? Falamma.
أنجاهم.
أنجاهم. You hide the sound of noon. Good job. Next one. إذا هم يبغون. حسن. How do you read it?
يبغون.
يبغون. You echo the sound of
ب.
ب. في الأرض بغير الحق. Who can tell me what type of قلقلة is this? What level of قلقلة is this? بغير الحق. Three levels of قلقلة we had. Weak, normal, and
strong.
Strong. Which one?
This is strong one.
Strong one. Okay. Whenever the ayah ends, or the you're just at the end, you just make a pause on the word, and the word ends with shadda. Especially this word ends with a heavy letter also. بِغَيْرِ الْحَقَّ. This is strong قَلْقَلَة. Okay? If the قَلْقَلَة letter or the قُطْبِجَد letter appears in the middle, alright? In the middle, it's weak قَلْقَلَة. But if it's it occurs at the end without شَدَّة, it's normal قَلْقَلَة. Okay?
Yeah. Remember. Yes.
So, next one. Tell us, Hassan, what is the قِلَة sign? Tell us.
قِلَة says us it's better to stop here.
قِلَة tells us it's better to make a pause here.
Yes.
But still,
you can continue.
You can continue if you want. Good job. يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ إِنَّمَا بَغْيُكُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِكُمْ أَنفُسِكُمْ
إِخْفَى.
The rule إِخْفَى. What about صِلَة? صِلَة is opposite to قِلَة, right, Hassan?
Yes.
So what does it say?
It says it's better to continue.
Better to continue reading, but if you made a pause?
No problem.
No problem. So مَتَاعَ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا ثُمَّ إِلَيْنَا مَرْجِعُكُمْ فَنُنَبِّئُكُمْ. Aha, فَنُنَبِّئُكُمْ. Here, إِخْفَى. I was really listening carefully to Ali Nasir that is he going to apply this rule or no? He did so. Very well. Perfectly.
فَنُنَبِّئُكُمْ
بِمَا بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ. That's it. I will recite this ayah. Let's repeat after me, okay? Ready, everyone?
Yes.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
فلما أنجاهم إذا هم يبغون في الأرض بغير الحق.
فلما أنجاهم إذا هم يبغون في الأرض بغير الحق.
غير Hussein, make sure غَيْرِ, okay? Say it غَغَيْ بِغَيْرِ الْحَقِّ. يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ إِنَّمَا بَغْيُكُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِكُمْ.
يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسُ إِنَّمَا بَغْيُكُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِكُمْ
مَتَاعَ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا.
مَتَاعَ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا.
ثُمَّ إِلَيْنَا مَرْجِعُكُمْ فَنُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ.
ثُمَّ إِلَيْنَا مَرْجِعُكُمْ فَنُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَعْمَلُونَ.
صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
أحسنتم. Brothers and sisters, thank you so much for being with us. Up to this time, that's it from us for today, for this session. Inshallah, stay with IRB English Radio for the next coming sessions. Thank you so much, Ali Nasir, Hassan, Hussein, and Masoom. Inshallah, we hope we should have you for the next sessions as well. Thanks to IRB English Radio, Sevier International Schools for Corporations. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
Let's Recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel continues to pound Gaza relentlessly with air and artillery strikes as the genocidal war's death toll nears 44,000. Hezbollah presses ahead with its retaliatory operations, hitting more Israeli positions in the occupied territories with rockets and drones. And the U.S. Special Envoy calls his talks with Lebanese officials constructive and says the end of the Israeli conflict is within grasp. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now to Gaza, where there has been more death and destruction as the Israeli regime's genocidal war rages on. Another Palestinian journalist has been killed.